Senator John McCain is running to secure a sixth term in Washington, D.C., but he continues to face vocal opposition at home from his own party. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about the Maricopa County GOP's decision to pass a resolution calling for the party to support, quote, anyone but McCain in the Senate primary. Plus, the Arizona Corporation Commission has been getting a lot of attention for items more related to politics than the job of regulating utilities. I'll talk with former Commission Chair Chris Mays about her research related to powering the future. How will utilities and the grid intersect in coming years? Also, you may not want to be thinking about getting your tax forms ready for the IRS already, but many crooks are. We'll talk to a new member of ASU's faculty who was recently an advisor to the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance about the need to modernize IRS computers and improve the tax return verification process. And a virtual trip to Africa with National Geographic Explorer Bob Poole. That and more on Here and Now after the news. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the Arizona Corporation Commission has been getting a lot of attention for items more related to politics than the job of regulating utilities. I'll talk with former Commission Chair Chris Mays about her research related to powering the future. How will utilities and the grid intersect in coming years? Also, you may not want to be thinking about getting your tax forms ready for the IRS already, but many crooks are. We'll talk to a new member of ASU's faculty who was recently an advisor to the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance about the need to modernize IRS computers and improve the tax return verification process. And we'll visit Africa through the experiences of National Geographic Explorer Bob Poole. We start today's program with a look at why many members of the Maricopa County Republican Party, including leadership, continue to dislike Senator John McCain so much. The Maricopa County GOP recently passed a resolution calling for the party to support, quote, anyone but McCain in the Senate primary. With me to talk about that is Republican consultant Constantine Quirard, who attended the Maricopa County GOP meeting. Constantine, what was this like? How did it come to this at the meeting?
It's an unusual occurrence. It's something we've seen sort of regularly with Senator McCain, but otherwise it's a very unusual thing. So you'd have to have a great deal of frustration and discontentment at the local district level, where you go to your monthly meetings and talk to the people in your district, and that frustration boils over before it makes its way to a county meeting.
So it's clear that when this comes to a head, that in fact people know this is coming. This is not a surprise for anyone who's attending.
Correct. This was announced probably, a month or two in advance.
When it finally comes down to this, is there hemming and hawing, or is there shouting? Are there people who are sort of throwing up their hands saying, what's the point of this? Or and the other side, people saying, no, we have to do this. This is important to send this important message.
I think it was about 1,700 people. So as you can imagine, it was kind of an all of the above. There will be people who are so frustrated that they feel compelled to take this step. There are people who are very loyal to the senator and he can do no wrong, and they will fight to oppose it. There will be people who will wonder what's the point, because we did this a couple of years ago and it hasn't gotten any better. Folks will say, hey, we shouldn't be fighting against ourselves. We should be fighting, with the Democrats. So you get kind of all of the opinions that register.
For those of us who are not involved in the party, I mean, knowing how feelings about Senator McCain can vary, as you just laid out there, a lot of people would still say, wait a second, this is a sitting U.S. senator who's running for another term. And it would seem like there's a potential to shoot the party in the foot. Based on what you know, is that a legitimate concern? Or I guess when it comes down to brass tacks, would people in a general election still vote for John McCain?
I think you have to remember that the people that you're dealing with here are very passionate about the topic. They take time out of their lives to volunteer for the party. They tend to be more ideological. They tend to be, really kind of passionate about the issues. And so I suspect at the end of the day, most of them will still end up voting for the Republican nominee in the general, but they're trying to make an impact in the primary and to send a signal to voters that, we're aware of McCain's misdeeds and we're upset about it, and we're taking these steps as a way of drawing additional attention to it. And also because it's part of sort of a running battle that's been going on for several years between McCain and the party. McCain tends to be a fairly vindictive person. Mm. He had been sanctioned a couple of years ago, so he and some friends put together about a $300,000 campaign to go out actually to target precinct committeemen, to actually target the activists in the party and beat them in their little local neighborhood elections so they could replace district chairman and control the party apparatus. which of course tends to backfire because then people really get upset. So it's not something that's reported on. It doesn't get a lot of media attention, but if you're active in the party, you're aware of the fact that this battle's been going on for several years.
Well, I recall more than a decade ago sitting at an Einstein's Bagels interviewing Rob Haney, and he ticked off all the problems with Senator McCain. I think at that point it was immigration, but also campaign finance reform. There were concerns as well. Does the ultimate outcome matter, or does it just matter that, you know, we're not going to be intimidated or we're not going to back down just because this person is a well-known U.S. senator?
I think it's both, and it motivates, you know, different people are motivated by different things. Sometimes you just stand for what's right, and if you pay a price, you pay a price. I was a district chairman for 5 years. I was on the county board for committee for 5 years. I was on the state committee. And, you know, the McCain folks targeted me, recruited a bunch of what we call paper PCs, people you recruit, but they don't come to the meetings. They just kind of give their proxy to somebody to make sure that I couldn't be a state committeeman. Now, I'm as active and involved and as giving of my time and treasure as anybody in the party. And I got punished because, you know, I worked for J.D. Hayworth instead of John McCain. So sometimes you just take the stand, just not to be bullied, just to let them know that, you know, we took your best shot. We're still standing. And that's unfortunate because obviously, you know, we have greater fights that we want to be spending our time on. But it's human nature. You make time for all the fights. They didn't do this instead of, you know, going after the Democrats. They're fully ready to go after Hillary or Bernie Sanders when the time comes. But this was a county meeting for internal politics, and they dealt with internal politics.
And finally, Constantine, is there room in these meetings for good, legitimate arguments that, you know, the old agree to disagree sort of thing? Or is there really, when you mentioned some people going after you and this idea that friends of McCain trying to take out certain precinct committeemen, does it actually get extremely bitter and does that linger? Or is this, hey, we're all in this fight together ultimately?
Yeah, I think that also depends on the people. I know the people who targeted me to take me out. At the same time, on certain issues where I know we agree, I still try to work with them because, you know, ideally politics is ultimately about addition, not subtraction. It is sort of the ultimate team sport. So to be most effective, it helps if you can compartmentalize. I know for some folks that's not possible, but hopefully for most of the folks there it is. And it seemed to be. They had a number of perfectly reasonable, you know, debates on other topics. You've got all sorts of candidates that are running against each other with tables filled with literature standing right next to each other, collecting signatures. You know, by and large, it's a good, healthy competition of ideas. Obviously, what gets the coverage, though, tends to be the food fights, and those can get a bit messy.
That's Republican consultant Constantine Courard. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking about the Maricopa County GOP's decision to call on the party to support, quote, anyone but John McCain in the Senate primary later this year. Joining me now with another perspective is Republican strategist Shane Wickfors, who resigned from his post as a precinct committeeman. Shane, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So what led to this decision? You're obviously a dyed-in-the-wool Republican.
I feel that I can have, as a Republican activist and a strategist, I could have much more of an impact doing other things than getting embroiled into all of the inner party political fights that take place. It has become very unproductive when you get into these meetings and you spend 12 plus hours going after one another. And not only that, but you're really limiting the franchise by putting people in positions of power that control access to information that allows you to do your job. So I'm just tired of a lot of the infighting. I think it's counterproductive. I feel personally that I can have a bigger impact talking with people one-on-one and also broadcasting through various different mediums. And so that's why I think it's better in my case.
And you definitely think things have gotten worse then?
I have. In fact, I've been a precinct committeeman for 26 years. I don't think I've seen it this bad in the entire time that I've been a PC for the Republican Party. So, you know, it weighed into my decision. It just seems like it's not very productive to do, to be a part of this infighting type of activity.
Why do you think John McCain brings this about in so many people? Is part of it just that he's been around and in power for so long?
Well, part of it is, yes, he has been around for quite a long time. He's considered part of the establishment. But I also think that there's some personalities in conflict. You mentioned Rob Haney earlier, and Rob Haney has, for some reason, gone to war with John McCain over the last probably decade or so. A lot of it revolves around immigration, and Rob Haney has been very successful in recruiting precinct committeemen into the party and to building this very, very vocal opposition to John McCain. And so it comes down to nothing more than a Hatfield versus McCoy type of situation, and it continues to escalate. And again, I think there's PCs like myself that just don't want to have anything to do with it. We would rather focus on addition and multiplication rather than division and subtraction.
Shane, do you think things would be different if, in fact, one of these so-called big names, whether it's Congressman Salmon or Congressman Schweikert, had decided to jump in on this? Would that have made the fight even nastier? Would it have made more sense to some people, saying that, okay, we're fighting with Senator McCain, and we're trying to get a candidate that maybe could appeal to a pretty good percentage of our voters?
It would have become very polarized. I've witnessed this firsthand because I was part of J.D. Hayward's team in 2010, and I saw what happened there. Many of these existing congressional folks that would possibly mount a challenge to John McCain understand there's somewhat of a decorum and a protocol as to these types of intra-party battles. And they are respectful of those protocols and decorum. And at the same time, you have to recognize that when you do take on a campaign at large, there are limited resources that you have access to. And John McCain has done a very good job at corralling a lot of those resources into his corner.
Shane, when these things happen, as you said, it's been happening for a while, it doesn't necessarily seem to affect the party from those of us who are not in the party and looking at it, because Republicans continue to be, certainly at the state level, extremely successful in Arizona. Do you see any way this does lead to the party shooting itself in the foot, or is it ultimately just, hey, we have a chance to fight about this because we have this strong candidate in McCain, we have some other strong candidates?
Well, the meeting in this case provided a forum for a very vocal public opposition to John McCain. Ultimately, I believe that when you do things like this, you end up shooting yourself in the foot in the public relations world, because what happens is it affects your capacity to fundraise and to bring new people into the party. I don't know why anyone coming in as a keynote speaker for the county party to help them raise money would want to do that right now, given the fact that the party has acted in this manner and behaved badly. So at this point, I think by shooting themselves in the foot, they've really cut off some possible resource lines that they could pursue in terms of raising money and getting things accomplished.
And do you think this sort of thing hurts when it comes to building the so-called big tent? We've heard from some Republicans who want to say that, you know, it's not just the Democratic Party that can be diverse. We want that too. Does this sort of thing hurt?
It does. I don't know how deep it hurts. I also should caution that your listeners should be careful in differentiating between the state party and the county party organizations. They're two different things. And in this case, I think it does hurt the state party, because the average person out there sees Republicans having this infight, and they assume all Republicans are having this infight. And so I think it does hurt our brand. We have got to get away from this, and if we're going to do any type of infighting, it really has to be done in private and not in these very vocal public shouting matches.
Republican strategist Shane Wickfer, as we've been talking about the Maricopa County GOP's decision to call on the party to support, quote, anyone but John McCain. Wickfer's resigned from his post as a precinct committeeman. Shane, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with former Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays about the Powering Tomorrow Phase 2 final report she was involved in. And then later this hour, we'll talk with Bob Poole of National Geographic about Africa. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum, presenting 26 rare drawings of Renaissance master Michelangelo, on loan from the Casa Buonarroti in Florence, Italy, and seen for the first time in Arizona. Now on view through March 27th. PHXart.org for details.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Well, it's mostly sunny across the state right now. Down in Tucson, 57 degrees. It's 55 in Casa Grande, 45 in Prescott. Up in Flagstaff, sunny skies, 38 degrees. It's mostly sunny and 69 right now in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, John and Pamela McDonald and Jessica Jones, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8257. Right now, with 44% relative humidity, it's mostly sunny in Phoenix and 60 degrees at 1122.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. As the phrase alternative energy has become a more common one, that clearly begs the question of what happens to our traditional energy sources. What sort of combination will we see? To what extent will the grid continue to be the main access point for energy distribution? Those topics are just a part of the Powering Tomorrow Phase 2 final report that was put together by four former state utility commissioners, including one from Iowa, one from Wisconsin, and another from New Jersey. And my guest right now, former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So how vital is it for these questions not just to be asked right now, but also exploring some of the possible answers?
Well, I think this is an incredible time and a very important inflection point to be doing this work and hugely necessary. And I think all you have to do is look at what's gone on in Arizona and now in Nevada, in which we've had these huge fights between the solar industry and the utility industry over rooftop solar and energy efficiency and storage and all these new technologies that customers are demanding, but that are taking revenues away from the utilities. And we have to find a way to solve that problem. It doesn't help anybody to have these two sides fighting. And I think the answer is to come up with a new regulatory paradigm that allows both sides to win.
In a general sense, do you think states are going to have to chart their own courses, or is there something that can be discovered that might end up working for a lot of states?
Yeah, and I think that you can come up with some secret sauce that maybe could be used for, you know, different states. I mean, the problem is each state is a little bit different in how they regulate their utilities and how they treat, solar and rooftop solar. But there are a lot of states that are similar. And so our idea is to come up with sort of a menu of regulatory options for reform that might work in certain regions, that might work across several states, and that states could then choose from as they go down this road of dealing with this friction between, you know, essentially the solar industry and utilities, essentially the growing demand of consumers to be able to produce their own power and to exercise their right to produce their own power.
So based on what you're talking about, all the ideas you looked into, is this a point where the utility companies are going to have to accept some sort of decentralizing? And is it better for them to start that early in the process to add on to what you're talking
about? Yeah. I mean, my argument always has been to the utilities and to CEOs, look, get ahead of this. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to be under the train. You want to be on the train. And so there's an opportunity now for them to do that. Decentralization is happening. I mean, look, all you have to do is drive down any street in the city of Phoenix or any city in Arizona. You see more and more solar systems on rooftops. This is happening. We're going to see a rise of electric vehicles. We are seeing an enormous explosion in energy efficiency because these technologies are declining in cost. So the utilities are dealing with essentially what telecom companies dealt with, 10 and 20 years ago with the rise of the cell phone. And so they need to be ahead of that. And really, regulators are at the center of that stage.
This might be a hard question considering how much work you've done on this, but regardless of the planning, this is going to be bumpy, right? Because whenever there's a great change like this, we're so used to, in some areas it's a co-op, but here in Arizona, obviously we're used to the major utilities.
Yeah.
When you start changing on this, even if the utilities were not as resistant to it, this massive change that's being forced on them, presumably by consumers, is going to cause some issues. Are there certain bumps you are more concerned about or less concerned about?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely going to be a bumpy road, and I think we have to be prepared for that. It wouldn't be realistic to think that this wasn't going to be a bumpy road. Utilities do occupy a central position in our society, certainly in the providing of energy today. It's a system that has been in place for 100 years, let's remember. It hasn't really changed in 100 years. And these are monopoly utilities with a lot of power, both politically and electrically in their states. So it's going to be a bumpy ride. I think that the biggest issue that I'm concerned about, really, frankly, is not so much the utilities, although there will be some utilities that are more resistant than others. But it really is our regulatory regime. And, you know, we have got to have regulators and the staffs of commissions, we're talking about public utility commissions here, who are willing to adopt change and to lead their utilities through this time of change. And so we need regulators. And it's happening in some states, Steve. So New York State is a good example. The governor of New York said, look, I want the utility of the future. I want to create the utility of the future, and commission, I am directing you to set up a process that will design the regulations we need for these utilities to change, to be a platform, essentially, for solar and energy efficiency and all of these technologies, to enable their customers to go solar if they want to, but also to still be profitable in the process. And that's what they're doing in the state of New York. This is happening right now in New York. This is happening right now in California. And this, to some degree, is happening in the state of Hawaii.
When you were Corporation Commission Chair, you and I talked a few times about this concept of the free market.
Yeah. That
there are some people who said the free market would fix anything. You seem to be kind of in the middle on that, where it's where we definitely want the free market. It needs to be involved, but to what extent can it? Can the free market play a role in this as
well,
we move forward?
Okay. I think it is. And I think that's in large part what you're seeing, which is a lot of solar companies becoming very effective. So you've got, you got the Solar Cities and the Sunruns of the world, and you've got a lot of other smaller companies in Arizona doing business very, very effectively. You've got energy efficiency companies, demand energy response companies like Enernoc. It is an enormous new industry and employing a lot of people. Let's remember that. This is a huge boon to the states that figure this out. We've got to make sure that we allow that to flourish while the utilities can continue. You know, I hate to say this, but to some degree, right now, utilities are too big to fail. They cannot just fail tomorrow. Much as some people might want to see that happen because, you know, folks don't like monopolies sometimes. But a lot of people, you know, there will be people who have to continue to rely on utilities. They're not going to go solar right now. They may go solar in 10 years. Storage, which is what is going to really allow for grid defection, is not there yet commercially. So when you pair commercially viable storage with solar, you'll be able to basically leave the utility. And that's what we're looking at 10 and 20 years from now. But it's not going to happen right now. So utilities still have to be around to serve the folks who aren't going to do this right now.
Thank you for mentioning the grid. I was wondering when we'd get to that. So so the grid has been the base of so much of this for 100 years or however long we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So what is the grid going to look like as things change? How much of the grid is going to be a backup and how much of the grid is going to be foremost?
I think that over time what you're going to see is the grid, the basic distribution system, as we call it in the Powering Tomorrow report, is essentially going to stick around for a long time. It will be there for the next 40 years. But I think that over time, it's going to become like an insurance policy. So you'll have utilities that are basically wires only or grid only. They're those monopoly utilities will basically operate the smaller lines that run up and down our street. But they might just charge us sort of an insurance rate. So if your solar system goes down and your storage system goes down, they'll be around to pick up the pieces, kind of like an insurance company does. And so I think that's what we're sort of looking at far down the road. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, we're not talking about tomorrow. We're talking about in 20 years.
The report also looks into low-income residents and the position they could be in. Think about free market. We think about everyone needs to have energy. Obviously, in Arizona, it's a place in the summer. What are you going to do without some sort of cooling?
Absolutely.
So what does that look like in the future?
Yeah, and I think that's a great example, Steve, of what we're talking about when we say utilities are too big to fail. Mm-hmm. They cannot not be there for those people who can't afford to go solar right now. We have to have the utilities there to serve everybody who needs to be served, and that includes low-income communities. And what we want also to do is set up incentives for the utilities and for other companies in the free market to go out and serve low-income communities. We don't want low-income communities to be without microgrids. We don't want low-income communities to be without solar. We don't want low-income communities to be without energy efficiency, certainly, because it's the cheapest form of energy there is. We want a system in which those targeting those communities with these new technologies is still profitable for everybody.
Chris, just a little bit of time left. I want to make sure we hit the big word infrastructure, because as you change the infrastructure, whether it comes to transportation or in this case, energy, people look at the expense and it worries folks when we look into that. And we tend to be sort of a short-term society because the costs looking ahead scare us a little bit. Mm-hmm. How much are we going to have to worry about changing the infrastructure when it comes to this?
Well, it's a big issue because there are large, there are many, many cities in the United States that have aging infrastructure that frankly have to be replaced. And what we need to make sure is we're replacing the right infrastructure, the infrastructure that should be there to facilitate decentralization, solar, energy efficiency, demand response. We don't want to be in a situation where the utilities continue to be incentivized to just go out and build big, you know, coal plants or other big power plants that frankly are going to be stranded assets. They're going to be obsolete 25 years from now, but yet we'll still be paying for it. So that's that is also what the Powering Tomorrow report tries to do, which is to set up an incentive structure for the utilities that breaks away from that 100-year-old regime in which we incentivized utility to build big power plants and jam it into rate base that we all have to pay for through our rates, but to go out and build the utility of the future, which is much more decentralized, much more neighborhood-based, basically, and much more focused on customers.
That's former Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Chris Mays. She was part of the report called Powering Tomorrow, Phase 2. Its subtitle, New Utility Industry Structures and Regulatory Packages in an Era of Increasing Energy Decentralization. Chris, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
You.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. This afternoon, Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas will present the annual State of Education Address to the Arizona House Education Committee. Douglas's speech is receiving a lot less attention than Governor Doug Ducey's State of the State Address, which itself spent considerable time on education. Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times joins me to put the Douglas speech in context. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So are lawmakers going to be yawning or paying close attention to what the superintendent has to say?
No, I think that it's always something that people pay attention to. Not in the same way, I don't think, as for Governor Ducey. You know, when the governor gets up and talks, he's talking about his priorities and the legislation he wants to see and the money, and specifically, that he wants to see going towards education or towards new programs or new ideas regarding education. When it comes to, you know, the superintendent, she obviously has a say in some of that, and she can certainly influence the legislative process, but she's not directly in control. She doesn't have a thumb on the scale in terms of some of the policy and the funding. So I think really it's an opportunity for everyone to look at to see, A, what her current view of the system is and after her first year of holding office, and B, where she wants to go in the upcoming year and maybe, you know, possibly in the next 3 years.
And how much do you think we'll hear about Common Core?
Oh, I'm sure we'll hear some of that. You know, that was obviously a major component of her campaign. She ran on dismantling Common Core, and there have been some significant changes to the Common Core protocols and standards since she ran her campaign, since she took office. Frankly, I don't think very many of them have much to do with her as much as they do with Governor Ducey and the folks that he's put on the State Board of Education. But that being said, there's no doubt that it's going to continue to be, I think, a major focus for her until a point, I think, at which she can claim victory on it.
Jim, how would you characterize her at this point as far as her base of power? When she started, a lot of people had questions about her. They were very quick to criticize her. But we've been hearing a lot more from, let's say, State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt as far as someone who has been critical of the governor's proposal. Douglas has not fit that position anymore. But are people taking her in general seriously because of the position she's in, or have they decided to sort of push her aside and admit, okay, she was elected, but we're not going to pay attention to her?
Obviously there's an amount of respect, I think, that comes with the office and withholding it. But I think a lot of people, frankly, even after this first year, are still trying to make sense of what she has done and what she plans to do with that office. I think the biggest hallmark of her first year in office is that things are in disarray between the Department of Education and its relationship with the governor's office and its relationship with the State Board of Education. They're mired in competing lawsuits against each other. There's a very public blow-up between Diane Douglas and Governor Ducey over staffing issues. You know, the top staffers over at the State Board of Education have left, and they've replaced one, but Diane Douglas claims that she's, basically illegitimate and she can't do anything. So there's a lot of things are up in the air right now. And so far, the one takeaway has been, that she has been a disruptor. And that was certainly something I think that she ran on. But I don't know that a lot of people understood exactly what kind of disruption she could cause at the agency. And I think for many people, I think it's a lot worse and maybe a lot more disruptive than they had anticipated.
And by grabbing hold of Prop 123, as the governor has done, and he's been the leader on that, talking about state land trust issues and going from there, has the Ducey administration effectively grabbed hold of K-12 and pushed Diane Douglas aside?
In a large way, absolutely. Diane Douglas has advocated for more funding, but she's not been a supporter of Prop 123. She does want to see more money go into schools, but she doesn't think that this is the right way to do it. I think she sided with Jeff DeWitt more or less on this matter. It's kind of an us versus them sort of mentality. And I would absolutely say, though, that Governor Ducey has really taken control of the policy discussions around education and has put himself in the role of a leader far more than she has.
And Jim, just to get your opinion on this, because you cover this so closely, I'm just curious, when we say that, it doesn't seem like it's that different to have a governor take hold of it. And yet, when we had someone like John Huppenthal, who had some ideas people deemed sort of different, but then also you had someone who was like Tom Horn, who was really a powerhouse politically, who always wanted to be in the thick of things. Is this sort of what we should more expect in terms of the governor sort of taking charge of a big issue? And then if the superintendent agrees with him or not, okay.
Yeah, it's certainly not unusual for a governor to get involved on education issues. I mean, Jane Hull did it with Prop 301 back at the beginning part of the century.
It seems so long ago, Jim.
It was 15 years ago at this point, so we're quite a ways from that. But at the same time, she did make that an issue and really championed it and obviously did have the support of the superintendent of public instruction at the time, which is a little bit different from this case. But I think in a lot of ways, you could almost say that you could view part of the governor's role in really grabbing the education bull by the horns here was that it was a way to kind of shove Diane Douglas out of the conversation a little bit and put her off on the sidelines, as opposed to letting her kind of be the central driving force of all the discussion that was happening around education.
Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about people who are trying to get your tax returns and take advantage
of
fraudulent
GMT.
Tax returns.
I'm Jackie Leonard.
And then coming up later on the program, we'll meet Bob Poole, National Geographic cinematographer. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, announcing its 2015 Encore Career Prize awardee, Russ Perlick, who applied decades of experience to serve a need in our community. More at pipertrust.org/encore.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Valley forecast calling for a pretty nice day around the Phoenix area. Mostly sunny skies, a high near 70 degrees. And if you like that, you'll like the next couple of days as well. Sunny with a high of 68 tomorrow and then back up to 70 on Friday. While public media sponsorships generate results, connect with smart listeners who support their city and their public radio station. For more information on how to be an even more remarkable business supporter, go to corporatesupport.kjzz.org. NPR's Here and Now is coming up today at noon. Chipotle is planning a company-wide meeting in February to explain what caused foodborne illness outbreaks at its store and how to prevent them in the future. And KJZZ's Stina Sieg takes us to Winslow, Arizona, to celebrate the legacy of the Eagles' Glenn Frey, who died on Monday. Here and Now from Boston starts at 12. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 60 degrees at 11:42.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. You may not want to be thinking about getting your tax forms ready for the IRS already, but many crooks are. So what can be done to protect you and to keep you from being taken advantage of? And what changes does the IRS need to be making? Sean Novak is a public affairs professor in the College of Public Service and Community Solutions at ASU. He recently served as a tax policy advisor for the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance, and he's the featured speaker next Tuesday night at 6 at the ASU Public Service Impact Talks. The TED Talk-style event takes place in downtown Phoenix, and Sean Novak joins me now. Sean, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So how long has this problem of fraudulent tax returns been prevalent?
Really first came to the attention of the IRS back in about 2008. And essentially what happened is criminals discovered that they could file a fraudulent income tax return and steal a tax refund from the U.S. government. And I think, you know, the problem just got larger and larger and larger as more and more people came to understand just how easy this scam was.
Are we in a situation, too, where the fraud wouldn't be recognized until after the refund was issued?
Yes. That's been a big problem for the IRS from the get-go. You know, one thing that's important to remember is our income tax system basically relies on voluntary compliance, you know, that the taxpayer files a tax return in good faith. And essentially, the IRS issues a refund in good faith. You know, so the system that we have is, people call it pay and chase, that the return, everything cannot be verified before the refund is issued. And that worked pretty well for a long time, but in an era of widespread identity theft problems, it's no longer a good model.
Did things get worse as e-filing became so convenient for folks?
Yeah, certainly e-filing made it much easier for the criminals. I mean, obviously, with the aid of computers, you know, you can process hundreds of fraudulent tax returns.
Mm. I wonder, what has been done so far? People always talk about the do-nothing Congress and whatnot. Has Congress acted in a way to try to make this problem less?
Yes, they did, actually. In the most recent omnibus tax and spending bill that was approved in December, there was a number of important provisions in that that should help to solve this problem. And, probably the single most important one was to move up the date that employers are required to submit W-2 information to the government. Okay, and beginning next year, that date is going to be January 31, which is the same date that employers are required to report that information to their employees.
I'm not sure how many people listening right now started to shake in their boots with the idea we even talked about the IRS, because most people are obviously not excited about the IRS when they get a note from the IRS. I mean, I've had that feeling in my stomach before. But ultimately, is there the ability for this to be a good relationship or at least a productive relationship between a legitimate taxpayer and the IRS?
Yes. IRS has really suffered recently, you know, say really over the last decade or so, you know, adopting new technology And it, the challenge that they face is, you know, obviously they want to do their work as efficiently as possible. But, you know, IRS is not a business. They're not like Amazon.com. They can't say, well, if you want to deal with us, it's go to our website, and that's the only way we do business. Yeah. You know, IRS has to interact with every single American, and obviously they want to do as much of it as they can efficiently, you know, through the internet, but they've got to be able to take phone calls from people. They've got to be able to meet with people face-to-face, and that's expensive. It takes a lot of budget resources to have the manpower to do that, because even if you're talking about 2 or 3% of the population, that still means you're dealing with millions and millions of taxpayers that need that service.
Well, that's why I wonder, is the issue of fraudulent tax return being taken seriously enough? Because it seems like there are certain kinds of people and certain kinds of returns that are targeted more than others. I mean, are we seeing low-income people getting hit even harder by this?
Yes. Certainly, people that are of more modest economic means are the ones that suffer the most from this. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that for many of these people, their annual tax refund that they get is by far the largest single cash payment that they receive during the year, and they plan around that accordingly. You know, they've got bills to pay with that tax refund, and so if they're a victim of identity theft tax fraud, those bills can't get paid, and they run into problems very quickly.
Sean, how many fraudulent returns are we talking about? You said 2 to 3%. Is there a specific number, though, as far as how many millions that would be?
Well, it would be the 2014 filing season is the last year that there's good numbers on. But IRS estimates that approximately 6 million attempts were made to steal tax refunds. So that's 6 million returns out of a total of about 150 million that are filed. Yeah. And then of the 6 million attempts, 5 million of them were stopped, but a million of them still got through. IRS estimates that they paid out a million fraudulent refund claims, and the total amount of money involved is over $5 billion just for that 1 year. So, you know, we're talking really big money here.
And it's somewhat easy for us to say, oh, a million out of that many doesn't seem that many. That's still a million people, and if it's someone that you know or yourself, that hits pretty hard.
Oh, it does, absolutely. It takes a victim on average, 6 months to a year to straighten things out with the IRS, get their account corrected, and get the refund that they're entitled to.
Sean, finally, I want to talk about some other things that can be done. Obviously, you mentioned modernizing the system. One thing as well that interests me is this idea that when we get a credit card receipt, for example, you don't see the entire credit card number, you just see part of it. What about truncating Social Security numbers? Is that doable? And if not, why hasn't it been done?
The recent Tax Act includes a provision in there that is going to require truncation of taxpayer identification numbers to be much more widespread than it is. And that, you know, that's certainly an easy fix. You know, and then the other thing that people need to do is they need to protect themselves. You know, be very careful about who you give your Social Security number to. You know, your bank and tax authorities, your employer, you know, they've got a legitimate need for it. You know, very few other people have a legitimate need for that number. And also protecting tax returns. You know, don't give out copies of prior year tax returns. You know, if that falls into the wrong hands, that's like a blueprint for how to file a fraudulent return.
And very briefly, about 30 seconds or so, what about the tax preparer that we choose? Let's say we don't use the online system. We actually go to someone. How important is it to pick the right person?
It's hugely important. It's definitely buyer beware. What people need to do is ask about credentials and make sure that your tax return preparer signs the return and they put in what's called the PTIN number. And that validates the return with the IRS that a legitimate preparer prepared it. Mm-hmm. And that preparer needs to give you a signed copy of that return. You know, and if they won't do that, then you're not with a legitimate tax return preparer. You know, shop very carefully.
Sean Novak is a public affairs professor in the College of Public Service and Community Solutions at ASU. He's the featured speaker next Tuesday night at 6 at the ASU Public Service Impacts Talks. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Being a photographer or cinematographer or filmmaker for National Geographic can be a life-changing experience. It also offers the opportunity to let other people know what's going on in parts of the world we may never travel to. And from that, we're able to learn more about the challenges that humans and animals face. Wildlife cinematographer Bob Poole has captured images of struggling elephants in Mali and has followed wildebeest across the Serengeti. And tonight he'll share those images and more as part of a National Geographic live presentation called Gorongosa Reborn at the Mesa Arts Center tonight at 7:30. And Bob Poole joins me now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Steve.
So it seems you were basically kind of born into this life. You were in East Africa. How did your family end up there?
Well, my father was a Peace Corps director. First in Malawi and then in Kenya. We moved to Malawi when I was 3 years old, and I grew up in Kenya.
At what point did you realize that the natural surroundings, that that life was something that, did you have an aha moment, I guess, even as a young person?
Yeah, I did. We grew up as a family spending as much time as we could in the African wild, and I got to know wildlife at a very early age. In high school, my father transitioned into wildlife conservation. And so from a very early start, I was able to work with National Geographic. They had come out to Kenya to work on an elephant film, and I managed to get on the crew as an assistant.
Did you know what you were getting into at that point?
I didn't know anything about TV or films or anything at that time. I was interested in photography, but it was really the adventure that I was after.
And yet the adventure, again, I keep coming back to this idea. Like for me, having grown up as a kid in Phoenix, the adventure would be different than growing up in Africa. And yet, was it what you knew, so it didn't quite, it felt like something normal for you?
Well, I had done a lot in Africa as a young kid and right the way through my teens. I had incredible experiences and tremendous amount of adventure. My parents loved adventure as well. But when I got that first assignment with National Geographic as a camera assistant, the cameraman invited me to come to his next location, which happened to be in South America. Yeah. And from then on, I was just bouncing around the world.
I want to talk about Gorongosa because many of us have not heard of it, and yet that'll be your presentation tonight. What is it? How did you find it in the shape it was in? And Reborn obviously indicates things are going better. Tell us that story.
Well, absolutely. I had shifted the focus of my career to work more on wildlife and conservation films when I sort of started to realize what was happening in Africa. And I bounced all over from, you know, Congo, Mali, Sudan, working on these amazing projects with National Geographic. And each one of those ones, I didn't want to leave. I kept having to go on to my next assignment. And then finally, in 2008, I got my first assignment to Gorongosa National Park. And it was an amazing thing. I was there to make a film for National Geographic. And when that was over, I didn't want to leave. And I just kept coming back one project after another to that park. And sooner or later, they asked me to join the board, and then we ended up with this PBS and National Geographic thought that the work being done there would make a great TV series. So I ended up staying even longer, and I actually spent years then in the park. And during that time, there was a long restoration project going on that was funded by an American philanthropist named Greg Carr. And he'd formed a partnership with the Mozambican government to sort of a 20-year-long project to restore this national park. And so when I first got there, I didn't see a lot of wildlife. But over the years that I was there, it all just started to come back. It was amazing. And so that's pretty much where my story starts.
Well, so what had happened to it?
Well, there had been a long war for independence against Portugal, which started in 1964. followed by an even longer civil war, terrible war. A million people were killed. And during that time, RENAMO, the resistance, based themselves on Mount Gorongosa, which is now in the park. But they, both sides of the Civil War, they fed themselves off of wildlife and they traded ivory for guns and ammunition. So when that long war was over, there was almost no wildlife left in the park and it was essentially left for dead.
So, Bob, people who go to Mesa Arts Center tonight will get to see some of these images, but folks who are just listening to us right now, I wonder if you could, can you describe for us a little bit what it looked like at its worst and how it looks now, in addition to the wildlife? Can you sort of describe what the setting is?
Well, you know, Gorongosa was lucky because although the animals had been killed, or most of the animals had been killed, 90%, let's say, the ecosystem was still intact. And so that gave the wildlife a chance with some protection to come back.
Yeah.
And that's where we are today. It is absolutely extraordinary to see how an ecosystem can recover if given a chance.
Bob, do you have a favorite part of wildlife? I mean, I mentioned in the intro elephants, and I've seen some of the images of elephants. Is there a particular creature or a particular part of wildlife you're especially drawn to?
Well, I really love wildlife, all kinds of wildlife. I don't have any I don't like.
Okay.
But elephants are special. They're a lot like us. They live long lives. They're very intelligent. They live in family groups. They care a lot about each other. And so elephants are special to me. And they're also special to my family because my older sister, who will appear in some video clips and images on this show that I'm doing tonight, is really considered to be the most or one of the most experts in elephant behavior anywhere, especially in African elephants across the world. So she made some remarkable discoveries about elephants at a very early age. And she came to Gorongosa and really helped us try to figure out what was going on with the elephants there.
In doing a little bit of reading on the work you'd done, I was struck by, and maybe I'm using the wrong word, but I was struck by the elephants in Mali, that mm-hmm. there was almost like a traumatization to some extent of what they had gone through, and that was sort of recognizable in the experiences there. Are you able to pick up on that? I mean, can you sense that, because the things you described about some of the similarities elephants might have to mm-hmm. humans, is it clear that what they're going through is really has been tough on them?
Yeah, I mean, especially in Gorongosa in Mozambique, there the elephants there. There was some 4,000 elephants in that ecosystem. When it was over this long war, there was probably about 200 left, and those elephants that are left don't like us very well. Many of them are tuskless because the soldiers didn't waste their bullets on elephants without ivory. They were using ivory to fund the war. So the elephants are pretty aggressive, and we have spent a lot of time trying to convince them that we come in peace. Elephants are also incredibly intelligent. People often ask me, by spending that much time with elephants that are very afraid of people, aren't you setting them up for failure? And the answer is no, because what the park needs is tourism. In order to survive in the long term, it needs people to go visit, and anybody who's interested in Africa would love Gorongosa. It's just a wild place full of incredible wildlife. The elephants there are starting to understand that people now are not going to hurt them. Mm-hmm. But they also know that people who come in tourist vehicles are not going to hurt them. But they still will know enough to watch out for people who would come to do them harm. And luckily in Gorongosa, for a couple of reasons. One in that most of the ivory was taken out of there. The elephants that are left are not carrying heavy ivory. But it's also very well protected by the park. Gorongosa Restoration Project and the Gorongosa National Park are working hard with the communities outside and the people around the park, and also doing anti-poaching work in the park. So those elephants are in pretty good shape right now. There's not, unlike the rest of most places where elephants are in Africa, those elephants are doing okay at the moment.
Bob, I literally just have a few seconds left, but I'm really curious. So wait, based on what you've seen,
mm-hmm.
you've seen human mistakes, but you've also seen humans help sort of conquer those mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
A few seconds. How much has that taught you about the human condition as well as the wildlife condition?
Well, what I learned in Gorongosa is that perseverance is what it takes to do real conservation, and you need to be in it for the long haul. And that's what it takes. And we really do have time. We can put so much of the world that we've ruined back together.
That's cinematographer Bob Poole. He's part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series tonight called Gorongosa Reborn at the Mesa Arts Center. It starts at 7:30. Bob, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on today's program. If you missed any part of the program, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great day.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Education News, providing original reporting on education funding, reform, and legislative happenings to promote informed public discussion on Arizona's K-12 education. azednews.com.